Imagine ripping out the entire nervous system of a major city, like just pulling it all out by the roots, and then trying to wire up this makeshift backup system in real time, all while millions of people are still actively trying to use it just to go about their daily lives.
Yeah, it's a terrifying scenario when you frame it that way, but honestly, that is the exact physical reality of a public transportation disruption. The pressure is just immediate
Right.
because it doesn't just inconvenience commuters, you know.
No,
Hospital
no.
shifts get missed, schools empty out, the whole regional economy essentially hits a brick wall. So that nervous system analogy is incredibly apt because everything else in the city relies on those signals moving flawlessly.
Welcome to today's deep dive. We are looking at the intense operational chess match that happens entirely behind the scenes to keep a city alive during a massive workforce disruption, like a transit strike, for example. And our guide for this is a fascinating, highly detailed operations manual. It's called Essential Mobility, a Guide to Transit Strike Continuity. And to be clear right up front for everyone listening, we are not here to debate the politics of the picket line. We aren't taking sides between labor and management or, analyzing the contract disputes. We are looking strictly at the physics of the problem. Like, when the theoretical negotiations fail, how do you safely move thousands of people who absolutely have to be somewhere with only a fraction of your usual resources?
Well, the operations team, they don't have the luxury of debating politics once a strike is called. They are just handed a pure logistics crisis. And the manual we're looking at, it does a brilliant job of dismantling the biggest public misconception about how you solve that crisis.
Which is.
The average rider, you know, they think that keeping buses moving is simply a matter of finding new people to just sit behind the steering wheel. We see the driver, so we assume the driver is the only piece of the puzzle.
Okay, let's unpack this because the manual actually calls this the ecosystem illusion.
Yes.
A transit system is this incredibly complex, interdependent chain of specialized roles. The driver is really just the tip of the spear. Behind them, you have specialized paratransit support. You have the dispatchers, who are essentially air traffic control for the streets, right? You've got maintenance technicians, the yard operators handling the fueling, the people running access control at the gate.
And treating all those open shifts as equally easy to fill is a, well, it's a massive mistake in continuity planning. Just think about the fueling process for a moment.
Okay.
A modern transit fleet isn't like your personal car. You don't just pull up to a gas station pump and swipe a credit card. These are often compressed natural gas vehicles or massive diesel rigs that require very specific environmental and safety protocols.
Right.
The text points out that you could have 50 fully qualified replacement drivers just sitting in the break room, completely ready to go. But if you are missing one trained CNG fueler, those 50 buses are not leaving the lot. The entire chain has to be intact.
But wait, if a let's say an enormous retail warehouse is short-staffed, they just call an agency, right? Bring in 100 temporary workers, give them a 20-minute orientation, and they are sorting boxes by noon. Why can't a bus depot do the exact same thing? It's just moving assets from point A to point B.
Well, the environment changes everything. A warehouse or a factory is a closed, controlled ecosystem. If things get chaotic, a warehouse manager can just pause the non-critical belts, lock the doors, and isolate those temporary workers to very specific, low-risk tasks away from the public.
Oh, I see.
But a transit system, it operates completely out in the open, on public roads, interacting with unpredictable civilian traffic. Every single decision is highly visible and highly safety sensitive. You're moving human beings, you know, not cardboard boxes.
Which introduces massive liability.
Absolutely. I mean, you're dealing with strict ADA obligations, the Americans with Disabilities Act. That isn't just a suggestion. It's federal law requiring agencies to properly operate wheelchair lifts, secure mobility devices, ensure equitable access.
Whoa,
Plus, you have dispatch coverage issues and field safety requirements. You cannot simply hit pause on a major downtown intersection while a temporary worker tries to figure out how to operate the pneumatic doors on a 40-foot vehicle.
so you can't just use a generic temp agency. The regulatory hurdles alone make that impossible. The manual dives deep into the pre-strike qualification process for replacement workers, and honestly, it is staggering.
It really is.
It's less like handing someone the keys to a rental car and more like putting them through a mini astronaut training program overnight. The checklists and hazard protocols are just relentless.
They're steep, yeah, but they exist to prevent catastrophes. You're putting someone in charge of a vehicle that weighs 15 tons and carries 60 lives at a time. The baseline requirement is a commercial driver's license, but that's barely scratching the surface.
Right, because you also need a specific passenger endorsement. I was looking into what that actually entails, and it involves rigorous testing on vehicle weight distribution, emergency evacuation procedures, blind spot management.
And then you have the drug and alcohol testing compliance.
Oh, man, yeah.
Which is a massive bottleneck in an emergency 24-hour deployment. You cannot rush biology, and you cannot rush federal clearinghouses. Every single replacement worker has to clear a strict chain of custody drug screen before they can even look at a steering wheel.
And the red tape extends far beyond just the drivers, too. If you are bringing in temporary maintenance and yard workers, they need hazardous materials awareness. Like, the manual specifically mentions something called lockout-tagout practices.
Right. Lockout-tagout is a critical safety procedure in any heavy industrial setting. When a bus is in the maintenance bay and a tech is physically underneath it working on the engine or the hydraulics, they place actual physical padlocks and warning pegs on the power sources.
So nobody turns it on.
Exactly. It ensures that another worker doesn't accidentally fire up the vehicle or release a hydraulic lift while someone is underneath it. If you bring in an untrained generic temp who doesn't understand those agency-specific facility rules, a simple mistake becomes a fatality.
Which is terrifying. And the source text actually introduces a company called RSS Inc., Regional Supplemental Services, as an example of how agencies actually solve this.
Yes, they're a great example.
They're a specialized staffing partner, and their entire business model is built around high-pressure workforce disruptions.
Mm.
So they don't provide temps. They provide fully screened, logistics-connected operational labor.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the true value of a specialized vendor like that goes far beyond just having a massive Rolodex of people with CDLs. What transit leaders are actually buying is predictability. The manual really emphasizes that staffing partners are evaluated on their ability to reuse the exact same qualified workers across multiple shifts.
Right, throughout the whole duration of the strike. Because if you have a different driver showing up every single morning, you are stuck in a permanent loop of day one orientation.
Exactly. You'd never get any buses on the road. Reusing the same operational labor builds predictable workflows. The replacements, they learn the routes, they figure out the quirks of the physical yard, they get to know the local radio protocols. Consistency is ultimately far more valuable than just the raw, sheer number of bodies you can throw at the problem.
Okay, but this brings us to a really harsh mathematical reality then. Even with a highly specialized partner providing consistent workers, clearing these folks takes time. You are never going to have enough qualified people to run the normal everyday schedule. The math simply does not work. You have maybe, what, 20 or 30% of your usual workforce?
Mr. Lucky, yeah.
So how does an agency decide who gets left waiting at the bus stop?
Well, they execute a system called route triage. And the underlying philosophy of route triage is recognizing that rider demand doesn't disappear just because there's a strike. The demand shifts. It compresses and it becomes vastly more difficult to manage. People still need to eat. They still need to get to work. They still need medical care.
Right.
So the agency has to determine their minimum viable service. What is the absolute bare minimum we can run to keep the city from collapsing?
And the manual outlines four distinct tiers of service triage. I think it's fascinating to look at this through the lens of a daily commute. So think about your own daily commute right now.
Mm-hmm.
Based on this system, you can actually figure out where you stand on their priority list. Are you riding a tier one lifeline or are you on a tier four route that's getting suspended on day one?
Yeah, it's a sobering thought. Tier one is the absolute lifeline of the city. We're talking about life safety and employment critical routes.
Uh-uh.
Hospital and medical district connections are prioritized above everything else. Major commuter corridors that feed the core economic engines of the region, those are in this tier. And crucially, this includes paratransit services.
And for those who might not know the term, paratransit is the specialized, usually door-to-door transport service for riders with severe disabilities who physically cannot use the standard fixed bus routes.
Exactly. It's medically necessary transportation. dialysis patients, for example, rely on paratransit to survive. That is why it sits firmly in tier one. Then we move to tier two, which focuses on high ridership corridors. These are the routes designed to move the sheer maximum volume of people efficiently, even if they aren't directly tied to a hospital.
Okay. And then tier three.
Tier three gets into the routes that can survive on severely reduced frequency. So maybe your local neighborhood bus usually comes every 15 minutes. Under tier three triage, it might only show up every hour.
Uh-huh.
It's highly inconvenient. You are definitely going to be late. But the geographic connection to the rest of the city still technically exists.
And finally, you have tier four. These are the services that are temporarily suspended completely. The agency just cuts them off, ideally with enough public notice so people can make other arrangements. But what's fascinating here is that the manual states this documentation has to exist before a disruption ever occurs.
Oh, absolutely. You can't be sitting in a conference room debating which hospital is more important while thousands of angry commuters are already crowding the sidewalks.
Oh,
that
yeah.
would be catastrophic. A resilient contingency plan separates mission-critical functions from the nice-to-haves months or even years in advance. This pre-planned structure is exactly what tells the staffing partners which specific roles must be filled the second a strike is called.
So the triage plan is mapped out, and the specialized replacement workers are mobilized, they're cleared. But theoretical planning inevitably collides with the chaotic physical reality of the transit yard.
Always.
The source text spends a significant amount of time detailing what it calls the first 48 hours. This seems to be the real make-or-break window.
It is an absolute pressure cooker. The manual argues that those first 2 days dictate the entire trajectory of the strike. If you gain control in the first 48 hours, you can manage the disruption. If you fall into reactive chaos, you will be bleeding resources and public trust for the rest of the event.
And the text outlines a very specific sequence of events for that window, right? Like activating the response team isn't just sending a group text message. It's about establishing a unified command structure. You have human resources, legal counsel, safety officers, and operations managers physically or virtually in the same room, working off the same whiteboards. You have to confirm the disruption, meaning you literally wait until the 3:30 a.m. pullout time to see exactly who actually walked off the job and what assets you actually have in the yard.
Yeah, that's the fog of war in transit logistics. You don't know your hand until the shift begins. Once you have those numbers, you deploy the workers based on that tier one triage list. And then you face one of the most sensitive operational challenges of the entire crisis, which is securing the access points.
Yes, the manual introduces the concept of strike security. Now, wait, how do you actually balance keeping these massive 15-ton vehicles moving through a depot gate without aggravating the actual labor dispute that is happening right outside that very same gate?
It's incredibly delicate.
Because you have union picketers, you have replacement workers, you have management all crammed into a tight physical space at 4 a.m. Doesn't heavy security just escalate the tension into a riot?
Well, poorly planned security certainly escalates tension. That's why the manual stresses that strike security is not just about hiring guards to protect property. It's about maintaining safe, orderly, predictable movement. You achieve that balance through incredibly strict negotiated procedures like supervisor escorts and controlled entry points.
The text mentions line pass procedures. What does that actually look like on the ground?
So a line pass procedure is basically a set of agreed upon rules for how vehicles cross a physical picket line safely. Management and union representatives often understand the parameters beforehand.
Okay.
For example, the agreement might be that when a bus approaches the gate, it stops. The picketers are allowed to walk in front of the bus, hold their signs, and chant for exactly 2 minutes to demonstrate their solidarity and delay the operation slightly.
Oh, wow.
Once those 2 minutes are up, the picketers part, and the bus proceeds at 3 miles per hour through the gate.
So it's entirely choreographed.
It has to be. Orderly security protects the replacement workers inside the bus, it protects the physical assets, and crucially, it protects the First Amendment rights of the striking employees to protest safely on the sidewalk. If an access point gets permanently blocked because of a disorganized confrontation, you don't just get a traffic jam at the depot.
Right. Both of them backs up.
Exactly. You miss your regional service window, and a nurse 10 miles away doesn't get to the hospital. Everyone has to understand exactly where to stand and how to move.
Okay, let's say the agency pulls off a flawless first 48 hours. The line pass procedures work, the command center is humming, the tier one buses are out on the street. Even then, managing the physical vehicles is only half the battle. The other half is managing the public.
Always the hardest part.
The riders are standing out in the weather, confused, wondering where their bus is. So what does this all mean for them?
This is where the reality check hits. A transit strike requires an agency to loudly and clearly acknowledge its own limits. The manual notes that vague updates from an agency are downright dangerous. If you just tell the public to expect delays, you create massive, unsafe crowding at transit centers. People miss critical connections, and frustration boils over into aggression against the few workers who are actually out there.
So communication has to be surgically precise. The public needs to know the exact triage status, like which routes are running. Is paratransit still doing door-to-door pickups? Are there alternate bus bridge options?
Right. And a bus bridge, for context, is when an agency uses buses to physically bridge a gap in service. Oh. So if a commuter rail line is shut down, they'll run a fleet of buses between the closed train stations. But coordinating that requires intense communication. And the manual is very clear that external communication to the riders is useless if your internal communication is broken.
Meaning the people running the system have to be looking at the same map.
Exactly. The yard supervisor, the replacement driver, the security personnel, and the dispatchers must be operating on the exact same assumptions. If a dispatcher looks at a screen and thinks a Tier 2 route is active, but the yard supervisor knows they didn't have a clear driver for it this morning, the dispatcher is going to tell the public the bus is coming. That conflicting instruction destroys public trust, creates immense safety risks at the bus stop.
And the source lists so many hard limits that agencies hit during these crises. I mean, you have route knowledge gaps because temporary operators just don't know the local detours. You have delays built into those security protocols at the gate. You have incredibly strained supervisor workloads because managers are working 20-hour shifts.
Yeah, burnout is a huge factor.
But wait, let me push back on this. Shouldn't a public agency, which is funded by taxpayer dollars, try to push through all of that and maintain 100% service? Isn't it a failure of the agency if they just admit they can't run all the buses?
It feels counterintuitive to our expectations of public service, right? But attempting to maintain 100% service during a severe disruption is actually a recipe for total systemic failure. The text is definitive on this point. The most effective agencies plan for reduced but completely reliable service rather than attempting inconsistent full service.
Because if you try to run everything, you end up running nothing well.
Exactly. You lose the most valuable currency a transit agency has during a crisis, which is trust. The core theme of the manual's operational strategy is that human beings can adapt to a modified schedule surprisingly well, as long as it is honest.
Right.
If a rider knows their bus is only coming every 90 minutes instead of every 20, they'll wake up earlier, or they'll coordinate a carpool, or they'll talk to their boss. They can plan their lives around a hard truth.
But they cannot adapt to a phantom bus.
No, they cannot adapt to inconsistent service that changes without notice. If an agency overpromises and says full service is running, and that bus simply never shows up because they didn't have the cleared personnel, somebody loses their job that day. Somebody misses a chemotherapy appointment. In the logistics of a strike, honesty is the ultimate operational tool. You have to acknowledge your mathematical limits early and publicly so that decision makers, both in government and in individual households, do not make plans based on a lie.
It's a profound way to look at civic infrastructure. And we've uncovered this entirely hidden ecosystem of transit continuity today. I mean, we explored the massive red tape and the stringent safety qualifications required for specialized staffing. Well, you can't just throw generic temps behind the wheel of a 15-ton vehicle. We walked through the brutal calculus of route triage, deciding exactly who gets a lifeline and who gets left waiting. And we broke down the mechanics of the first 48 hours, the careful choreography of strike security, and why brutal honesty is better than phantom service.
And what's truly essential to take away from this manual is that these strategies extend far beyond labor strikes. The source explicitly connects this exact staffing and triage framework to broader continuity planning. The vendor agreements, the facility access plans, the command center structures, these are the exact same tools that transit agencies quietly use to survive massive winter storms, natural disasters, or severe sudden workforce shortages. These frameworks are secretly protecting your city's mobility every single day. The agencies that bounce back from a crisis are the ones that have already defined their minimum viable service long before the storm clouds gather.
That concept of minimum viable service really changes how you look at the city around you. We talked extensively about route triage, those tiers from 1 to 4, where tier 1 is a hospital lifeline and tier 4 gets quietly suspended. So I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. The next time you see your city function seamlessly during a major crisis or bounce back overnight from a massive disruption, ask yourself, What invisible triage decisions have already been made about you? And what other vital public systems in your life right now, your running water, your power grid, your sanitation services, have a secret tier 4 list that you might be on without even knowing it? Think about that the next time you tap your transit card and step onto a bus.